Welcome to Phoenix Rising with Dr. Z. This podcast is all about conversations about healing and rising from the ashes of your grief and trauma. In this podcast, we will be deconstructing and highlighting the different aspects of grief and loss. I'm your host, Dr. Christina Zampatella.
One of the most salient things about pet loss is that for those who have that bond, and again, that's not universal to have that kind of a bond with a pet, but in cultures where we do, or in families where we do bond very deeply, the loss is often disenfranchised because it is not socially accepted. One of the ways that we see this come through is in the workplace. You don't get bereavement leave for your pet. And so what you'll find is some people may still be able to use bereavement leave, but then it doesn't fall under any sort of FMLA.
Right.
So they can use leave that they have, but it doesn't get that same protected status that a human loss does. And there are reasons for that. When someone is out of the workforce, it then places a burden on the organization and the other people who are working there. So, you know, we understand this, but it still makes it very difficult because it's not recognized structurally. What ends up happening then is you have people who desperately need support and help with their grief who don't have an avenue for that. I mean, I remember having a job, I was brand new there, and I took a sick day because my cat had died the day before. Now, I did not know at the time that my boss not only was a cat lover and a cat parent, but does fostering and rescues of cats. Had I known that at the time, obviously I would have just said, hey, my cat died. I'm sick. I can't stop throwing up.
Right.
Instead, I just said, I can't stop throwing up, right? So I actually short-circuited an opportunity for empathy and support because I was assuming that my grief wouldn't be welcome. And so that's something that's really important to recognize, that we need to educate workplaces on the fact that this is a legitimate type of loss. And to recognize that even though there may not be federal protections in terms of bereavement leave, telling people this is a perfect opportunity to use your sick leave,
right,
if you have any, or at least not get in trouble if you're going to take leave without pay. Recognizing it is significant and it is important for that person to be supported. Now, this is where it becomes very difficult, as often the workplace doesn't have a policy. It's not even a thing. And then somebody loses their pet. And now that person who's grieving and already lacking emotional and cognitive resources due to their grief is having to educate their boss or the people around them on the experience, which is one of the things we can do is we can be proactive in educating people on pet loss. This has changed significantly. This used to be something no one really talked about. Not only do we have journals and support groups and health groups and, you know, online forums, but we also have articles in the Washington Post and the New York Times. WebMD had an article on it.
Oh, wow.
All of these different articles on top of the research, because usually those articles are citing other studies,
right,
are highlighting the significance of this attachment and how devastating it can be when it is gone, when that pet is dead and that attachment, then those bonds are stretched because the person's not there to reciprocate that affection.
Mm-hmm.
So finding ways to have continuing bonds. Mm-hmm. And recognizing that there's another area of pet loss we haven't talked about that yet, and that's when pets are rehomed.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Be very difficult because there can be significant guilt for abandoning the pet. There's often public recriminations.
Yeah.
There is guilt if anything happened to the pet, even natural causes related deaths. because you weren't there, there's this magical thinking that if I had kept them, I could have protected them. And so there can be a lot of guilt and shame and stigma, but that is also a type of loss. I mean, I can, the first pet I ever had was Dusty.
Oh, hi, Dusty.
And that's not the best picture, but that shows him with me. This was him.
Oh, hey.
We were living in a military base, and my dad had, we had to move because he had finished his term and he was going to go to college, and we could not take him with us, and my parents had to rehome him.
Oh, my God.
And that was the best dog in the world. Mm-hmm. He, from the day I came home from the hospital, he decided I was his. And everybody needed to get permission before they approached me, except for my mother. My mother was out of this world. But that is something where there's a grief there, because frequently you don't stay in touch. It's not like fostering, where often there's an open relationship between the adoptive parents and then the foster parents. Mm-hmm. Then there's a continued, like the foster mom for some of my cats, we still send each other pictures regularly. She shows me her new fosters, and I show her pictures of the, we call them the twins because they were roommates, they were litter mates. And that's a beautiful way to continue, but that doesn't always happen, especially if it's due to you're having to relocate due to health problems, like you're going into a nursing home or assisted living.
Oh, huge.
If you're being relocated for work or the military, sometimes to another country, where the quarantine process sometimes can be more traumatic for the pet than having to acclimate to a new home. Mm-hmm. And if you're not able to take good care of a pet, I am absolutely an advocate for rehoming. The, as long as you find a good home for them, they will bond. The animal will be okay. They will form a new attachment. In which way it's hard for us. But what will sometimes happen is, instead of rehoming, people will let a very untenable situation continue to the point where then the animal ends up being euthanized because of behavioral issues. And then there can be significant guilt and trauma for the family because of that.
Sure.
And we have social media. The mob will descend.
They do descend. If you watch these Facebook pages, it's like, holy shit. I mean, it's like you are fresh meat in a piranha tank. They have a lot to say about it.
If you have an animal who is high strung and a nipper, and now you have a newborn baby, mm-hmm. if you know you're not capable of keeping the baby safe, you might have to rehome the pet. You can't rehome your kid. That's a lot harder to do. we're very not forgiving, because we have these two ends of the spectrum. We have the, well, pets aren't attachment figures. And then we have the other end of it, where you're supposed to sacrifice everything in the world for that pet. You know, oh, your kid has allergies. Well, get rid of the kid.
Right.
We jokingly. Sometimes that's not an option. And so we need to be okay to encourage that rehoming, as long as you know it's to a good home, is okay. But also recognizing there's grief there as well. That the animal may experience grief, aka behavior problems, and that the human may be experiencing significant guilt and grief. I mean, my mom grieved Dusty till the day she died.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
She felt like she was abandoning her own child. And so that's something that's really important, to recognize those losses. And so I think with that, that sort of forays back to, I remembered what I wanted to say earlier, talking about a sort of publicly acknowledging grief over pet loss. There are some foster parents who have these amazing online platforms presence, where they share about their grief, especially those who do medical fostering, where you have a high needs animal. And so if you guys have never heard of her, the Kitten Lady, I believe she's in California. She's phenomenal. And she deals with high risk medical fostering. And so you get to see her talk about her joy in helping home you know, pets to new families, her joy when she's able to help him overcome medical needs, but also her devastation when it doesn't work and there's an animal who dies. And more saliently and recently for her, she lost one of her cats. And she didn't unload everything, right? You need a place to heal. But she shared enough of her story that it made it okay for people to say how much it hurts. Tina, and I'm blanking on her last name, is another one. She's in the Midwest and she only does high-risk medical fostering. And she had, you know, the diaper duo, and her pets were just world famous because they were paraplegic cats.
Oh.
And she talked about her devastation when she lost Pippin. And when she lost Pippin's best friend, who was also a paraplegic cat.
Wow. You know, you said something about animals grieving and all of that, you know, the whole, the rehoming as well. But a lot of times I'll have two dogs at the same time. Right now, I have chosen to have my one dog who was paired with another dog that I had lost, with Nuka, who was a human in a dog body, and just very, very different than any other dog that I had. I was very attached to him. But when I had Nuka before Akaya, who I have right now, I had Misu, because clearly I do not know how to name these animals. So anyway, so I had Misu, who was a golden retriever, and Misu and Nuka were very attached. Well, Misu died unexpectedly, and he was a golden retriever, and they tend to have a shorter lifespan and a lot of medical problems. And he was one of those dogs, like one of those animals that went to the corner of a backyard. And I did not know about that kind of, like, that's where they're often, you know, taking themselves to die. So I'm getting all choked up. So I grabbed him. I called my best friend. I'm like, something's wrong with him. You got to help me. And she knew what was going on, but she still drove over to help me. But anyway, when Misu died, I brought Nuka over to the veterinarian, so that he could see that, you know, Misu had died. And I don't know if whether or not that hit him or not, you know what I mean, if that impacted him. But what did impact him, when we went home, I was sitting there, he had grabbed, this is going to make me cry, God damn it. He grabbed Misu's toy, went over to Misu's bed, put the toy down, scratched the bed, looked at me and whined. And I just started sobbing. Animals know when they have lost another animal in the house, how they express it. Like I said, he was a human being and this 120-pound body. And he knew, he absolutely knew. And I just never seen an animal express so directly the loss of, you know, another animal that, you know, they live with. Like, I had another dog, Kobe. He was an actual therapy dog. And I used to bring him to work. And it did not occur to me that my clients were going to grieve at the same time I was freaking grieving. And I don't know why that didn't occur to me. I was young in my career. So now Akaya, and knowing that now still, I bring Akaya to the office. And Akaya is part border collie. So she'll go out to the waiting room. She will round up my client and take the client back to my office. And she'll do that with other people's clients, but she's not dog friendly. So two of my other employees have animals. So we have Tank Tuesdays, which is like this little Chihuahua, non-yippy, long-haired Chihuahua that belongs to one of my employees. So she brings him on Tuesdays. I've got Akaya there on Wednesdays and Fridays. And then we have Sadie Saturdays, and Sadie belongs to one of my other clinicians. And you know what? I think it's freaking cool. And I've never had anybody have any difficulty. We ask, you know, are you okay with dogs or whatever? But a lot of times they're like, oh, where's Akaya if I don't bring her in? And a lot of times Akaya is looking at me when I'm on my way out, like, we're going to work, right? Like, that's what we're supposed to be doing right now. And I'm like, dude, got a doctor's appointment after work, can't bring in. So I think we got to remember that, you know, the animals do recognize each other's loss, that rehoming, like you said, rehoming can be extremely traumatic in some ways. Like, oh, I've had to move. I got a divorce and now I got to move into this apartment and the apartment only allows one animal and I have to choose between my two freaking cats, or I'm going to figure out how to hide my second cat because there's no damn way I'm not taking my cat. So, or you know what I mean? Like, there's a lot of reasons why it happens.
Absolutely. I mean, those are all incredibly important components. And you also brought up something that made me think, one of the things that I think with the guilt when we do have to euthanize, it is so devastating when you have a human who is considering whether or not to engage in additional medical treatments.
Mm-hmm.
Frequently, either they're cognizant enough, you can have a conversation and ask them what they want, or they are not able to, they may not even be coherent or awake, but you have a history of having talked to that person. So mm-hmm. you have a sense, even if it was just their reaction to something they saw on TV about life support or not, you have a sense of what they may have wanted. Mm-hmm. With animals, we can't have that conversation. And so that's one of the things that I think can make it so challenging when you're trying to decide to euthanize or to wait. And in both ends, we always regret what we didn't do, right? So frequently, we'll regret it if we euthanize. Well, maybe I should have just held out a little bit longer. One more day.
Conversation with myself. Absolutely.
And then on the other end, there are people who struggle with, did I wait too long?
Mm-hmm.
Because then you know that they were suffering. And so balancing reality with our own expectations, that is a hard thing to navigate and to forgive ourselves. And for other people, when we put our grief out there, to forgive us. I would say I'm a big proponent of, if you're grieving, don't put it on social media. If you have a controlled group, like a small forum, or you have a lockdown page where only people who love you and know you can comment, that can be a beautiful way to get support. But putting it out there for the world to see if you're still raw may not be in your best interest. You have to look at protecting yourself and what is going to cause you more hurt. Because when you're grieving a loss, when we're in the midst of it, everything everyone else says can and will be used against them mm-hmm. in a court of emotion.
Yeah.
I am always very, very polite with anybody who's in the customer service industry. I can only think of one time where I was ever short. And even then I told the person, I'm not mad at you. This isn't your fault. It's not directed at you. I'm mad. This is a policy that is stupid.
Right.
Right. And I was saying goodbye to my cat. This was during COVID time. They wouldn't let you come in for anything except for if the animal was dead or being euthanized. You could then come in and say goodbye. That was it. It was an emergency hospital. Go in to say goodbye because she had died while they were trying to help her. She had kitty cat stroke and it started seizing. And so we're allowed to come in. She'd already died. I mean, at that point, I'm pretty sure she was gone when she was in my arms when I handed them to her through the car window. And so my husband and I go in and he goes out to tend to the bill. And I'm sitting there holding hope. Well, no one else is in the room. I take off my mask to kiss her goodbye because she was my cat for 18 years. By God, I was going to kiss that cat goodbye. And the young woman who was working there comes in. You can't take your mask off.
Oh, my God.
I
would have slapped the mask off her face.
I did not raise my voice. I did not cuss. I did not get physical. I just said, well, my cat is dead. I needed to kiss her goodbye. And I can't exactly do that with a mask on now, can I? If you're worried about germs, there's the door.
For you. You go.
And she's just like, well, you're still supposed to keep it on even when no one's in the room.
And you're at an emergency vet, like of all the places, you know what I mean?
And I said, I don't care about the rules. Mm-hmm. And I kissed my cat again, said goodbye to the cat. It was Poke, pulled my mask back on and left. And, you know, she wasn't trying to be harsh, but in that moment, I was furious.
Well, like, she handled it a little bit different, Rebecca. I mean, she really could have done it a little bit more sensitively.
All she could have done is backed out of the room and said, you're supposed to have your mask on. I'm going to leave. Please knock on the door when you've got your mask back on. Problem solved.
Yep.
Easy peasy. But again, that's the kind of thing after the fact. So just recognizing that in the moment, things will be very hurtful that were not necessarily intended to be hurtful. The other thing I wanted to say, because I had two thoughts as you were sharing your stories with your beautiful babies, and you were talking about animals grieving one another. I will say another reason I personally advocate for in-home euthanasia whenever it is possible is it also gives the other animals a chance to know what's going on. So I did not know what it was going to be like. The first time we had it happen, we'd gone to the vet, cat suddenly started acting funny, x-rays, it's not treatable. Mm-hmm. Entire midsection was filled with tumors. She had just had blood work done 2 months before, seemed perfectly healthy, no indicators of anything. So we take her home because we're like, we're going to do this at home, not at the vet's office where she hates being. We bring her home and call, find someone who's willing to come over that afternoon because at that point she was in excruciating pain. And not only did this vet talk through everything with us, but one of our cats who had been tortured by the other cat. So they weren't the best of friends. They liked each other, but they would give each other some respect. Simmy comes over and she wants to see what's going on with her big sister, Alpine. And so the vet, as she's explaining, okay, this is the first injection we're going to do just to relax her. And Simmy comes over, she lets Simmy smell everything. And so she's actually, it was almost like Simmy was another child and she was explaining to us, but she's showing Simmy and letting Simmy be a part of the whole process. And then Simmy curled up and sat sentry until Alpine died.
Okay. Ugh.
And our other cat who was close to Alpine, they would snuggle together, was in the other room. So before the vet took her out, she actually went over and she let Poke smell Alpine. Mm-hmm. Hey, your buddy is dead.
Yeah. Yep.
And then took her away in this beautiful little basket with a baby blanket, like a receiving blanket. It looked like a little bassinet. That kind of thing helps the animals too, because then they see the finality. It's not, wait, where's so-and-so? I mean, yes, there's still that looking, which happens, but it's a way to actually make the best of what's a really awful situation. Now, there are a lot of experts that say this isn't for everyone. Not everyone can handle being present. That is where I have to keep my judgmental self in check.
Sure.
And just, you know, because I'm like, how can you not be there? Not everyone is able.
Yeah, I mean, I think we have to normalize that too. It's too much.
Especially in some cases where someone has had a lot of loss, it may be especially hard for them because they can't live through that again, especially if they've lost a lot of other humans and animals, that can be really difficult. Right. Is normalizing that grief is normal, but also recognizing that there might be guilt there too, that the person needs to process and learn how to forgive themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And so sort of recognizing that there's got to be space for everyone and all of their feelings.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and everybody having a different experience. I'm going to pivot on us just because I'm aware of our time, if that's okay. And I want to talk about, you know, I worked in a center for the visually impaired for 4 years. So I've certainly seen a lot of service dogs. You've got service dogs, then you've got emotional support animals. Those are different. So service dogs are working in, like I said, like in service of somebody who may have a disability of some sort. There are, and my viewers know, and my listeners know that I have epilepsy. So, you know, they do have dogs that are, you know, that can sense that you're getting ready to have a seizure, and they do things, try to pull you down into a safe space. And that's more of like a, not that they're not emotionally supportive, but, you know, they are working. They're working animals that you can create, you know, those relationships can be very deep, but an emotional support animal is a little bit different. And not that there's not a surface or a service that's provided. It's just, it's a different relationship. And so at the University of Delaware, we get a lot of, you know, emerging adults who are having a very difficult time transitioning from being in the home environment into the university environment. And, you know, want their animals with them, which, dude, I totally get. But I also get the fact that sometimes if they have an emotional support animal and they're also trying to navigate the, like the psychosocial component of being in college, you know, now their cat is there and now their cat's alone all night because they decided that they were, you know, going to go out with their friends overnight. And then the cat and, you know, the dog or the cat, if they're left there, isn't necessarily supporting them, or it precludes them from having to navigate the launching process and having to learn how to attach to other people because they just feel, you know, that that's their safe attachment in the space. Yeah. So this whole writing a letter for an emotional support animal, like we've had conversations here in the Delaware Psychological Association of a lot of people being hands off with this decision because there has to be permission, right? So I have decided on my end, as much as I understand, I would like to have taken my dog or my cat to, you know, school with me. I am also aware that I feel torn about that decision, not calloused against it. Not, I'm not saying like, no, you shouldn't have it. You're going to have to deal with it. It's just, I just feel very torn about it. And so because I don't have a strong stance with it one way or another, I've decided to withhold making any kind of decision in that way until I know how I feel and what I think ethically is the right thing to do. And I might not be able to come to an answer. So what are your thoughts on that?
So, well, this is actually the first time I've been asked this type of a question. So,
you know, welcome to me.
I'm trying to think through the different layers. So in many ways, when you have an emotional support or companion animal, they function as both a secure base, that attachment. They also can function as a transitional object. So you think of a small child with their stuffy or the special blanket, their whoopee. These are things that a child uses. And they actually serve a function because they help the child to deal with other things when the parent or the primary secure figure is not around. Right. So whoopee, the stuffy, those are transitional objects that allow the child to relocate further away from the secure base of the human.
Absolutely. Gotcha.
And absolutely, that can be a challenge because when we're talking about someone going away to school and wanting to bring their animal, that makes even more sense if you think of it in the language of a transitional object.
Absolutely.
Yeah, not that animals are objects, but self-object needs inventory can be used on humans too, right? So one of the things that I think that's really important is to recognize that scaffolding, that transition needs to occur before you go to campus or before the 2 weeks when you're doing move-in. I'm sorry?
What does scaffolding mean? What would that mean in this case?
Scaffolding in this case, I mean building up to. We talk about scaffolding our skills. In this case, I mean building up the skills to emotionally self-soothe and self-regulate in an environment where you don't have your companion with you. In this case, it may mean going further away from the animal, little test drives, or being away from the animal for longer periods of time. And it's very different for the person who has a companion animal versus the person who has their teacup poodle in a purse and insists that it has to go into Home Depot with them. I'm not even going to say anything about that.
They make great decisions about how much lumber you need for like building things. I mean, you know.
If I could have my cat help me pick out paint color, you know, tap the right ones.
Probably would be better at it than me. So, I mean, it can't get any worse.
No, that's not true. I've seen your office. You have beautiful space. But a companion animal is different. So this is not someone, and I think that's where for administrators that can be difficult because the administrators are having to toggle different components. One, do you have any allergies or any phobias of animals in the dorm environment? Two, there can be health issues or concerns, especially if you have an environment where then it's a dog and it has to go out, has to go for walks, getting in and out of the dorm. That can be a complication. Animals need space.
Mm-hmm.
Consideration. So from an administrator's perspective, it can be very difficult because even for those that recognize that there are companion animals, they may still feel the same way I do when I see a poodle in the Home Depot. Mm-hmm. But there are those who do recognize the importance of that companion animal, and they absolutely want to support the student, but also recognizing they can't because it's not safe. It may not be safe for the other humans, the other students. It also may not be safe for the animal. Yes, you can put a cat in a dorm room, but the likelihood of them escaping through a window or a door is much higher. Finding a cat on a dorm in a dormitory environment would be much, much harder. So it is not necessarily safest for the animal. And I think that's where talking to the young adult, the different pros and cons and recognizing it could actually be traumatizing for your companion to be in that environment. And you may likely not be allowed to take them into a classroom. Again, safety, allergies, other people who may have genuine phobias.
Mm-hmm.
And recognizing that phobia over Fluffy is just as legitimate as someone's social anxiety.
Yeah.
And so navigating that. So what I recommend absolutely would be baby steps, opportunity away from the companion animal, find another transitional object. So if the animal, the companion, is a transitional object from other humans' secure attachments, what can you use as a transitional object when you're away from your pet? Is it a lock of their fur that you've shaved off because it'll grow back? Is it one of their favorite toys, like their favorite pet mouse or chew toy that you can tuck somewhere where others may not know it's there, but you can pet it for comfort?
Well, and you even showed me a couple of pictures. My screen, it is my dog. I mean, anything that allows you to feel that connection, I think that's really smart and important.
I mean, I love pets. They always ask, are you a cat person or a dog person? I'd pet a triceratops if I could and it would allow me to. Like, this is not a one-year-old that has any fear of big animals.
Like, you got all the pictures in front of you. That's so freaking cute. Do you remember when I called you? I'd never owned a cat before. I had Vito. I adopted my first cat in my life 2 days before I had my knee replacement. Vito Calamari Williams, or Zampatello Williamson. I know it's obnoxious. I don't even give a shit. I think it's a cool name. So Vito, I remember I knew something was wrong, or I thought something was wrong. I'm on the phone with you. I remember walking out on my back patio, like sobbing, going, I don't know what to do. And you're like, it's okay. This is like, you had to talk me. Like, I needed a support person for my animal because I did not know what to do. And now I know, you know, a lot better. And of course, then I pick another cat because I'm going to be the crazy old cat lady who is Luca Salvatore Zampatello Williamson, because why not stick with the Italian theme? And, you know, and now, and of course, Vito ends up having to have surgery. He's got these things. He's the most expensive cat I ever thought I would have. And I, like I said, I would gouge my eyes out for him. It's ridiculous. But do you remember doing that with me on the phone with you?
I absolutely remember
Yes, sobbing.
different options, second opinions, what to do if we, things that were, we talked through all of that.
Did.
They are so important to us when we have that kind of attachment with them. And I circle back to just sort of making sure that if I were going to give, three takeaway points.
Yeah, let's do that. It'd be a good place to do that. Three takeaways.
Three takeaways. One, recognizing that pet loss can be very disenfranchised because there's such a wide variety, and recognizing that. The second would be validating your feelings of guilt and horror and the piercing pain that can come from your pet loss that may be very different than when you lose a human. Not that the grief is more, but there is a cutting edge that can come from the guilt because we're their caretaker and often we can't predict what's best. So learning how to forgive yourself through that. And then the third one would be that psychoeducation piece, just realizing that if we can fix that psychoeducation piece, we can go a long way toward preventing that disenfranchisement.
Yeah, I love it. Oh, those are three really imp I'm so glad. And I'm glad that I have such a, you've got that academic background, but you've got such the personal background of it. It's such a perfect match for today's podcast. And so I just want to thank you again for coming to another podcast, which I am sure I will ask you to do another one again in the future because you're awesome. I appreciate it. To my viewers and my listeners, we just want to go ahead and thank Dr. Morse for coming and sharing her expertise with us. This is a hot topic. I imagine you may have some thoughts or questions about that. Stick them in the comments section. I'll be sure to monitor that. And if you appreciated this podcast and you wanted to learn more about other kind of topics around grief and trauma, like and subscribe. And if you found some value in today's podcast or any of the other podcasts that are out there. There are a lot coming out, a lot of important topics this last go around, losses to, drug use, caregiver loss to COVID, et cetera. Lots of different ones. So thank you so much for joining us today. And thank you again, Dr. Morris. And
thank you for having me.
thank you. This is so important. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to Phoenix Rising with Dr. Z. If you found this podcast helpful, please share it, subscribe, and leave a rating or review wherever you get your podcasts. We want to be a resource for anyone who is experiencing loss, and this is a simple way you can help us spread the word. Check out our show description. There you'll find a link to connect with me on social media, as well as helpful articles and resources.